Hi, this is Rob Simone, and I want to tell you about my brand new show here on the Paranormal Radio Network. Each week, I bring you the most interesting people on the planet, the most in-depth discussions, and the most controversial issues. We go where no talk show dares to go. Join me every week for the Rob Simone Talk Show here on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network.
Hello everyone, Trish Sheridan, host of A Global Focus. Come join us each Friday evening at A Global Focus's new time, 9 to 11 p.m. Eastern. Come, Trish.
Breaking news, strange black pyramid UFO ships over every major city on the Earth. People are exhilarated and scared. Reptilian strange creatures are beaming down. My God, they're beaming me up with them. Don't put that probe there. Don't put that probe there. Don't put Listen to the Church of Mabus radio show at 11 p.m. Eastern, Saturday nights with host Jeffrey Pritchett, bringing you the high strange. Visit www.churchofmabusradio.com. That's www.churchofmabus.com. Radio.com.
Yeah! could have seen it coming when I got a little brighter. With the moonlight like day in California, day was gonna go, but I was gonna move ya. A little low, did she was screaming under the breath. I love my baby to death.
Mavis, everybody. Having some technical difficulty tonight from the storm, I guess, down in Florida. I'm not sure what it is. But, are you there, Jeff?
I'm here. How are you tonight, Jeffrey?
I'm doing better, except for the technical difficulty. Hopefully it'll go away. I'm not sure exactly what's going on. Hopefully it'll clear out. But there, the panhandle was just covered with a giant storm, so I'm not sure exactly what the deal is with that, but it seems to clear it up some, but apparently affecting something, because I hear, do you hear that?
Oh, yeah.
I'm trying to do a show about it, you know, help us out with technical difficulty.
So I understand what you're saying. There's just a little bit of an echo behind it.
Yeah. So, Corvus, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Okay. Well, hopefully it'll go away as we progress. Well, tonight's guest, let me pull up the info sheet here. Corvus Nocturnum, in a show entitled I, Lucifer, Anton LaVey, Church of Satan, 666, History of the Devil. And tonight's co-host is Jeff Mudgett, author of Bloodstained, about H.H. Holmes.
So, basically, I guess let's get to the show and hopefully this echo go away. I don't know what the deal is with it, but it normally doesn't do it. So hopefully it'll clear up as we progress.
We'll pretend we're in a cave.
Hello, hello, hello.
So, Corvus, if you could, tell us a bit about yourself as far as you're a media representative for Church of Satan, correct?
Yes, sir, I am. I've been an author and publisher for the last 7 years, ever since my debut book first began, which was Embracing the Darkness, Understanding Dark Subcultures, back in May of 2005. And I pretty much have worked pretty steady full-time since then as an educator, lecturer on radio, television, and multiple books on alternative lifestyles and religions to explain to the general public what these different subcultures of society, or identity groups, if you would call them, really, truly are, so they're not stereotyped and misunderstood by everybody.
Interesting indeed. Does anyone right now have a microphone on or anything that may be echoing my voice at their house or anything like that?
No, actually, I'm not online at the moment, other than that.
You know, and Jeffrey, you're on Corvus's voice is crystal clear.
Okay, so I'm just making sure that's not one of the situations. All right, well, I guess, Corvus, how did you get involved with Anton LaVey's Church of Satan? How did that take place?
Well, that was kind of an interesting little excursion in my life. I was experimenting and exploring different religions and philosophies to try to get a broader, deeper understanding of how other people were in the world around me. And unlike the normal people that want to presume that I had a bad upbringing or someone in the church turned me off on them, per se, that wasn't the case. I came from a Protestant family that was fairly devout in their beliefs, except my grandmother one day stopped going to church, and I asked her why as a child, and she said, because I don't need a man at the pulpit to tell me how to read a book. I can do that myself. So it rather inspired me to question and learn, for myself and be objective. And in doing so, I met a lot of different people. I started going to different meetups and online forums, things like that, and just asking people what they believed and why and what different religions actually were. And I encountered Native American spirituality from different tribes, paganism, Wicca, all different religions. And I stumbled across Satanism by a friend of mine who handed me the Satanic Bible, and I'd never heard of it, never seen it prior to that. And he said, here, this is more along the lines of how you think and the things that you talk about. And I was rather intrigued. It wasn't exactly anything, actually, compared to what I expected it to be. I thought it would be more of a Luciferian or devil worship, just like everybody else. And, I found that it was more of a pragmatic, practical, psychological philosophy on common sense and why ritual was more about psychology and the human animal and what our needs and wants are, and that really intrigued me. So I joined, and I interviewed the now high priest, Magus Peter H. Gilmore, and included him into the book and some other people, and I just kind of took it from there and kept going with it. And I was appointed warlock a couple of years ago, which is a second and third rank within the organization beyond just member. And then because of my work in different books and some television work that I did on the Lexi show explaining Satanism to the international audience, Magus Gilmore bestowed upon me a media agent.
So when it comes to Satanism, is it belief in an actual being or more of the dark side of humanity, like the energy? Could you explain that a bit?
Satanism per se, as far as Anton LaVey's church, yes, it's very much tapping into the archetype. We don't believe that the devil actually exists other than what people have created of it through a shared idea. And we don't take it from a literal viewpoint of it's an entity, it's a power that other cultures and other religions do. We take it for the tongue-in-cheek adversary role where we question authority and dogma and rigid mentality and explore what man's carnal nature says that we just instinctively are, but do it in a responsible manner.
So when it comes to like the stereotype of Satanism, like from let's say a horror movie, and or a Christian's fanatical view of maybe Satanism as associating it with evil deeds and hurting people, that is just mostly a stereotype on many levels. But like with Satanism, of course, there's going to be people that perhaps practice it and do that and take it to a different extreme. Just like, for example, there would be a Christian who would bash it crazy too and handle snakes and bless their kids. So there's evil in every belief system. There's someone that can make it false than what it actually is, right? I mean, what's the difference as far as some the stereotype that people try to put against it compared to what it actually is?
Well, we basically have a modern-day witch hunt, especially during this the 1980s and 1990s era, when you had people like Mike Warnke and other so-called leaders during the Satanic Panic era in the book Selling Satan. Then we have Jeffrey Victors, who was a little more realistic in Satanic Panic, speaking about all the different waves of child molestation and sacrifices and, you know, things like that that were just ridiculous. And even the FBI stepped in and did a field study and investigation thoroughly within the Church of Satan and just occultism in general and found it to be unfounded. I actually spoke to a gentleman who was the profiler at the FBI during that time period, and spoke to him in great length while I was researching I, Lucifer, writing the chapter on the Satanic Panic, and he said he went into it as a devout Catholic and FBI agent for the government, and his job was to go to different crime scenes, interview people, met up with the people that wrote the book, Michelle Remember, that was very famous during that time period, and he pretty much called the people out for being idiots and that it was a conflict of interest because the gentleman who is the expert psychologist was interviewing his patient was actually his wife and totally did an about face on, you know, telling people within the government, hey, these are unfounded, malicious, and slowly the whole Geraldo era hysteria just started to disappear.
All right, Jennifer Corvus, we're going to take a small break, and there's a great possibility, I think, that Joe, our producer, is going to try a different account. You may have to recall everyone. We're going to try to see what this echo is on my end and see if that'll get rid of it. So we're going to take a small break, and we'll reconvene in a couple of minutes and see if this crazy echo will go away. My end. Okay. It may be my cell phone, which it's never done this before ever, but the storm may be doing it. I don't know, but it's annoying.
Sounds fine. I'll be here.
All right, we're taking a break. We'll be back shortly. Knocked out. Seems as if God was trying to intervene with this show. God, you'll get your airtime next month, all right, buddy boy, if you know what I'm saying, because next month we're having a show about God. Dr. Amit, friend of Deepak Chopra, and a book called God Isn't Dead. That's right. So God, tonight Satan's turn. You get your turn next week if you know what old Jack means, all righty? All righty. Never rub another man's rhubarb. That's right. We got it taken care of. We're back. We're back, and we're rocking it with our cockatiel. That's right. All right. Jeff Mudgett, you there?
I'm here, buddy.
All right, Corvus, are you there?
Yes, I am. Can you guys hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you good, and the echo's gone too, thank goodness. So tell us a bit about Anton LaVey. I read his book when I was younger, and I'm from the South, so at first it freaked me out, like, because my dad was a Baptist preacher, and then he died, so the next thing you know, I'm, like, going crazy, doing drugs and reading the Church of Satan Bible. So back then, it was pretty creepy to me. It kind of freaked me out a little bit. I know it has a giant list of, like, all the demons and stuff in it, and it was, like, Jehovah's worm-ridden head and stuff like that. So I was like, oh, my God! Satan! But, so tell us about Anton LaVey, a little bit about how he founded the Church of Satan, and if we could, just a little background on him.
Okay. Well, back in the 1950s, Anton LaVey formed what was called the Order of the Trapezoid that later became the governing body of the Church of Satan. It was composed of 9 unknown individuals from around the world that pretty much followed the lead of the Hellfire Club of England, a cult secret society type groups where he tried to bring about the crystallization of concepts of Nietzsche and of Ayn Rand and other pragmatic philosophers and occultists. He didn't prescribe so much to the whole occult necessity of, you know, magic is real sort of mentality. It was more a matter of magic and ritual or psychodrama and play acting for adults who wish to basically flush their mental system of all their emotions and feelings. Basically, it's advanced therapy and counseling. And what he wanted to do is he took all the herd mentality and institutionalized thinking and eliminated it. And he wanted people to be liberal minded, or, you know, literate at least, to where people are self-disciplined and motivated, and we are the opposition. We epitomize nonconformity. I pretty much got a lot of media publicity doing one of the earliest satanic baptisms of his own daughter. He performed a marriage for one of the Navy officers, I do believe it was, during the 70s, and of course, the, you know, television and Time magazine and things like that were covering it like crazy because it was such a big deal. And I do think that Magus LaVey was quite happy with the attention that he got for it. He enjoyed the limelight, but at the same time, he quickly grew tired of explaining the same tired questions of, no, we don't worship a real devil, and we don't sacrifice children. And he said, I love my children and my animals, so it's preposterous. And, he went a little bit more underground after the 70s and 80s when the satanic panic was starting, but other members stepped forward, people that are magisters, reverends, and, you know, elders in the organization now were on the front against the Geraldo scare tactics of the satanic panic. And Anton died in, I believe it was 1996, and unfortunately I never had a chance to meet the man, but I do believe I would have gotten along quite famously with him.
Definitely, yeah. Hey, Jeff, you got some questions up your sleeve there?
You know, I do, and I, Corvus, it's a pleasure meeting and talking to you. Your subject is fascinating. I'm going to play a little good cop, bad cop here tonight and take the role of maybe a news reporter and try to fill in what I know Jeff's listeners are thinking right now. Your comment was, we don't worship the real devil in Satanism.
Right.
Well, what do you worship?
Well, that's a really good question, actually. That's the greatest follow-up to, we're the church, but we don't worship Satan, so... I applaud you for having the insight to come up with that one. We worship the ego, the individual self, and the higher evolved idea of what we as humanity can become. It's a very egocentric, but self-motivating, empowering religion, if you wish to call it a religion. It is protected by the government as a valid religion because we have holidays and hierarchy and things like that. But in a nutshell, it is more of a philosophy to me.
Okay, and you being a writer, we both know that the words you pick to describe what you are go a long way and maybe are never erased from the stereotype that fits into the mind of your readers. That word, that Satanism, why would you use that word to describe a viable religion?
Well, Anton was actually asked that often in his life, and his heads of his church later answered it on the same grounds, that it's fun. It gets attention. People stop and go, what is that? And it's easy to point to the arc, the figure that prides pride and self-accomplishment as the figure of anti-martyrdom, so to speak. By saying you're the opposition, the rebel, the accuser, you're basically turning things around on individuals who are small-minded and stereotypical. Anton LaVey said that he chose those words on purpose to exclude people that were too narrow-minded to really stop and ask the same question that you did. If they're going to believe it to be something that they want it to be, then they're not willing to look deeper, and therefore there's less conflict for him, although I do understand that the majority of the masses are going to just automatically blanket assume that it is devil worship.
Excellent. See, you also made a comment which I agree with. You said the basis for your beliefs, maybe not the basis for your beliefs, but one of the objectives was to maybe define and explain man's carnal nature. Now, are we talking a sexual basis?
Yes, it definitely can be. The satanic statements, the satanic sins, and the 11 rules of the earth that are in the satanic Bible are all talking about indulgence over abstinence and man's vital existence over spiritual pipe dreams and hypocritical self-deceit. But it's also about elite Epicureanism, and for what that means to the people out there that don't pull over a dictionary constantly have to take a child to fuck.
Hello?
Hello, yeah,
hello?
Something just happened.
I've got you good, Jeffrey.
Corvus, are you still there?
Yeah. Nope.
You killed Corvus. I don't know what happened.
There's a big thunderstorm over your head, Jeff.
Hello. Sorry.
You're back. I don't know what happened. Yeah, there was a thunderstorm over my head. It's kind of cleared up now, but yeah, it was really bad. I think that was just like a weird fluke kind of thing that hung him up. I don't know exactly what it was. But I guess my question is, Corvus, How does the Church of Satan, and let's say in particular Anton LaVey and, you know, the members, how do they feel about the Christian God?
Actually, we don't really think that much of it one way or the other than what the followers tend to do with their beliefs. We do kind of look at it as more of a primitive mindset, just like any religion or mythology or folklore, it's a belief in something outside of the individual. Man has always had a need for projection of something beyond themselves out of fear, because we're scared of thunderstorms, we're scared of fire, we're scared of noises in the dark. So early man created gods and goddesses, demigods, heroes, villains, and things like that in order to explain the things that they were afraid of or that brought out their emotions. And as advanced and modern as we think of ourselves in this day and age with science and empirical evidence and, you know, things like that, the majority of human beings still need something intangible to put their beliefs into because we're still secretly afraid. Satanists don't prescribe to that particular mindset, and we kind of look upon other people that do with a smile and a wink as though, you know, they're being hoodwinked by themselves.
So, I think in Anne LaVey's Satanic Bible, and also your book, where is it? I have it right here. Satan's Minions, A Guide to Fallen Angels, Demons, and Other Dark Creatures. In Anthony LaVey's Satanic Bible, doesn't he list all these demons or fallen angels by name? And what is the perspective on that? I mean, is that a belief in, like, the actual beings or, like, maybe emotions? Or what does that mean exactly?
Okay, well, it sounds very complex, but I'll try to break it down as easy as I can because it took me a while to get this part myself as I poured over a lot of volumes. On the surface, if you were to just skim through the Satanic Bible and, you know, pick certain sections out without reading the whole thing or deeper interviews with the man who, it does sound a little contradictory between we don't believe in the devil versus using the names in ritual. But you have to understand that for Satanism, these demons or the devil are psychological aspects. We're taking elements from mythology, and we do consider Christianity to be in just another mythology. Just it happens to be the predominant one of the land. And we use them as symbols or the emotional context that they were originally used in. Like, say, one of the demons is all about sexuality. Another demon in the Middle Ages was all about greed and money, like, let's say, Faust or something like that. He was more about the physical, tangible wealth. So we would use those in rituals to help evoke that powerful emotion that's been ingrained in people over the eons. And it's all about just tapping into a feeling, not the literal sense. The reason why I wrote Satan's Minions is it's supposed to be kind of a fun encyclopedia of what those different creatures are and where they came from, who invented which ones. I'm not saying that they're real. I'm saying that, you know, here's brownies and elves and fairies and, you know, other types of creatures are listed in the book, too. I mean, when was the last time anyone saw a black flaming horse ride through the night? But back in, you know, the 1500s or so, the Gaelic and Irish people believed that it was as real as you and I. So I'm just trying to add to the collection of someone's occult library there. But as far as Satanism itself, it's different.
Yeah, it's kind of like demonology. Like, that's, I mean, I've seen a lot of people that say they're demonologists that write similar kind of books, so it's kind of like classifying and stuff like that.
Right. I wasn't trying to, you know, say I wrote this, therefore they're real. I was writing it as a researcher scholar of this is what other systems have used, and it was interesting, and I really like the imagery and the artwork and, you know, what makes people tick. That's what appeals to me about these different things, is it's fascinating.
Definitely. And in your book, I, Lucifer, Exploring the Archetype and Origins of the Devil, as far as the history of the devil and the origins, where does that start? Is it the Bible? Is that the ultimate source of the start of the devil completely? Or is it, could you give us a bit of background on the history of the devil?
Well, I originally thought it was too, just like everybody else. But actually, it's very shocking to me in my research, digging for years, that the devil himself predated Christianity by several hundred years. If anybody out there is familiar with the movie 300, about the Sumerian and Mesopotamian and the Babylonian cultures that came before Christianity, each of these cultures had their own version of the devil. It's something that mankind has always projected out there. It is the embodiment of all of man's primordial fears. The boogeyman, so to speak. So my research found the devil is actually the Christian devil, that is a crystallization, a combination of facets of other cultures. Like in Egypt, we had set. We had Tiamat in the Babylonian-Sumerian time period, and it just became a pick and choose of different characteristics, and how the devil even looks was altered over the, you know, Dark Ages and before. I mean, he started out as a beautiful angel that became twisted and hideous, and the early church took elements of the Greek god Pan. If we're familiar with Pan's Labyrinth, I mean, there's obviously some cloven hooves and horns and, you know, a half-man, half-furry beast combination is where Baphomet comes from. All these things predated Christianity, but when you say the word devil, that's what the majority of people think of, is the red furry horned guy. And, you know, a lot of this came from Greek and Roman mythology or paganism.
Yeah, I'm a Capricorn, and my whole sign revolves around Pan, and definitely Pan got, you know, bad rap from the devil thing, I think, in a lot of ways. No doubt about it. Definitely robbed blind. Pan got robbed blind on that one.
Yeah, I do believe that the Middle Ages version of the devil to, I'd say, the early 1900s came more from Pan than any other one single source. Of course, there's other tons of elements that my book describes of where it came from in other religions. I'm not bashing Christianity or any religion in my book. I'm trying to be as unbiased of a scholar as possible. But I started this book because I myself was curious, where did it come from? Why did it change? And why do we have, you know, the South Park-looking devil sleeping with Saddam Hussein in comparison to Rosemary's Baby or The Devil's Advocate with, you know, Kenny Reeves and things like that? I was like, why and how do we have such a wide, you know, differing viewpoint? And I'd have to say that this was the most labor-intensive I've ever done out of all, you know, dozen of them that I have. And it was actually the most fun, even though it was the most work, because I enjoyed the subject material.
So when it comes to the devil and the different cultures, we know the story. Everyone's pretty much familiar with the Christian version of Lucifer, you know, trying to take over heaven and the war of the angels and Archangel Michael casting him down to earth and, you know, the dragons that fell from heaven and that whole story. You know, that's pretty much the one that everybody's familiar with. But are there other creation stories of any other sort in, like, these ancient civilizations or that we know of from their belief systems or anything?
Yes, actually there's a religious scholar by the name of Jeffrey Burton Russell who did a deep examination on the devil that I poured over. I've got most of his books, and he was a theologian, you know, scholar, so he was really thorough. You know, I owe the thanks for doing a lot of years of research before me. But the Muslims have their own version of Satan, what they call Al-Shaitan, meaning born of anger. He was one of the jinns, which is where we get the word genie from today. In their creation stories and their fall of the most powerful Iblis, which was the ruling spirits of the jinn, fell from their heaven as well. So that was probably the most equal mirror culture that happened around the same time. But before people say that, you know, one borrowed from the other, I think they were simultaneously created from different parts of the same continent at the time, because if you look back in ancient Persia, Zoroastrianism occurred hundreds of years prior to Christianity, before Muhammad, before Jesus, and they had a similar story themselves. So I would say that Zoroastrianism is the earliest form of the fall of the creature that became a devil.
Yeah, it's you know, it's interesting, no doubt about it. As far as where does the origins of selling your soul, was that where does that start? And Satanism, is there any type of ritual that goes around that on some level? I'm sure y'all don't actually believe you sell your soul to Satan or whatever,
no,
but
Well, we can very well sell our soul to something that we don't believe exists. That's like giving a letter to the Postal Service saying, send this to the North Pole for Santa Claus, it's what I want for Christmas, is how we would look at it. You know, there is no literal sell your soul to the devil. Something like that kind of originated back in the time that Faust was written and the dark ages of European Christianity, when people were, like, say, Luther, were afraid that the devil lurked behind every corner. And, you know, he had a shadow shouting that the devil was there watching him, and, you know, things like that. When the height of superstition and religion was the only salvation or answer to any of the things that were going wrong with the world, like the Black Plague, and it was sweeping the entire continent and wiped out huge portions of mankind during that time. You know, so for us to say that, oh, well, you sold your soul to the devil and the horror movies and things like that is kind of a little bit of a chuckle to me, because it's like, do we seriously believe that sort of superstition that came from the Dark Ages when we're in the year 2012? It makes good fun, it makes good reading and good entertaining, but it's no different to me than going out and watching Percy Jackson and the Lightning Thief of the Greek gods and things like that. It's entertaining for sure, but we don't believe at all that there's a devil you can sell your soul to at all.
Yeah, and Faust, that story, I love that story, or anything about that story, but that's the root of it too on some level. Of course, there's Black Sabbath, sold her soul for rock and roll, of course.
I put a whole chapter in the book on the devil and rock and roll, because there are great iconic images about the devil in rock and roll, and you know, it's the ultimate rebel against society and so-called good versus evil. I mean, how could you ignore Ozzy Osbourne, and you know, we've got Marilyn Manson, who was a member of the Church of Satan at the time when he was in his heyday, and you know, things like that, where we're shoving it in people's faces as a rallying cry against the oppression that a lot of people grew up feeling that the church tried to get them to conform and be so rigid in their thinking that they rebelled. And, of course, Satanism feels that the devil is the ultimate rebel, so we kind of allowed that to continue. You know, it kind of backfired on people that instead of being the boogeyman that scared people away, it became the focal point to where people felt that there is finally something that they can come to that they agree with, even though it's fictional and it's a cool motif. They responded positively to those ideas. It's like the very thing that you say is bad is what caused people to run to it.
Yeah, it's like, you know, with Christianity, there's certainly a good side, and I believe that there's some truth in it, but there's like this dark side to Christianity that's hurt such in our world through religion and war and just people that are, you know, leaders in the Christian religion that are just sociopaths. And I see Satanism as kind of like a rebelling against that and saying, screw you, you know, we're going to become what you fear, and just here you are, you know, boo. And is Marilyn Manson still in the Church of Satan?
Technically, he never fully renounced his membership. But he hasn't been a public spokesperson for many years, and even though the high priest of the Church of Satan still gets along with him pretty well, they kind of have a parting of company, so to speak, in a matter of at least, you know, each side has evolved and grown separate from the other, but I wouldn't say that he's no longer part of things, he just isn't active.
He finally just came out with a great album and had sort of a comeback with that Born Villain album that got good reviews. But I've been there since Portrait of American Family, and I saw some albums that went up and down, but Born Villain, I've been reading reviews on it, and it's did very, very well. It's definitely a little comeback there for him. But, you know, as far as, let me look at my Joker cards here. I have that I'm interested in knowing. And also, after this question, I'll let Jeff, you know, get some questions so we can balance out, balance Jeff and Jeffrey out, by the way. Double chrome dome, we're back. That's right. Two balls.
Yeah. And proud, and, proud of it.
That's right. It's bald not by choice. No, I shaved my head because I have a Bruce Willis receding hairline thing from chemo 15 years ago. But anyway,
I understand that. I have short hair and took a foot off myself from where it was, so, you know, I understand.
Yeah. Three balls in the house. No, I'm just kidding. But, I forgot what I was going to say. Oh, okay. Let's say, in the satanic standpoint, you have an enemy. Like, either a person or some type of establishment since I'm going through some mortgage trouble. And let's say, I'm not going to say their names on air, but let's say my mortgage company has become my enemy. If I was a Satanist, what would I do? How do I feel about my enemy, and what would I do to get rid of my enemy? And is there spells? Is there a ritual? What? How does that play into effect if I had an enemy I needed to ditch?
Well, if you were looking at it specifically from your point of view, you know, first of all, as a Satanist, you would want to look at the entire situation as realistically as possible. I mean, Satanism is foremost about responsibility and individual accountability. So you'd have to look at the situation. Is it truly warranted, or are you just being emotional on, you know, what's going on? Say, you know, if it's a mortgage company, are they coming at you because you chose not to, you know, make payments, or is it a matter of were they unwilling to work with you when you did try to contact them? So that would be the first point, is to look at this whole situation, or whoever you're angry with, really, to see if it's your fault, their fault, or neither. But if it is clearly someone else's fault, yes, there is a destruction ritual in the Satanic Bible, and also the Satanic Rituals book that Anton LaVey wrote, too. One of the primary ingredients is black, and you describe the individual's name with parchment and ink, usually. And you take a photograph if you have one, or something symbolic or visual that you can burn and destroy while writing out your curse on the individual. Because what you're doing is you're releasing the anger and the hatred so it doesn't fester and well up inside you and come out in a very inopportune moment and cause yourself more harm when it really shouldn't.
Wow, you just described me perfectly there in that last sentence.
it's a matter of getting things off your chest, really.
Yeah, that's healthy, sort of. You know, it's like hitting a punching bag. Or, yeah.
Exactly. I would tell people all day long that Satanism is all about self-therapy and making yourself into the best person that you can for the best life that you can do.
Yeah. Well, my situation with the mortgage thing is more of a money lack of situation and trouble, having money trouble, and then it leading to them being assets.
Right. Right, I understand.
We're going to a lawyer Tuesday and looking into our options. So, and then the company today sent the mortgage company sent this nice kiss about they want to work with us and help save everything after, like, being complete jerks and saying they're going to take everything. So it's like, I'm just going to talk to a lawyer before I say something terrible to these people and make it worse. Because, like, I can't even talk to them on the phone anymore. I'll just say something crazy. I've already threatened to send Occupy Wall Street there. Tennessee, which will probably never happen, but I've been going around to Occupy Wall Street groups and telling them to go there. Of course, I tried to get them hacked by Anonymous. It didn't work. But hey, I'll try the picture thing, print out a picture and see what happens. But Jeff, you got some, go ahead.
I was going to say, that's probably the most productive and realistic thing you should do. Otherwise, certain other things might get you into more trouble than you want.
Definitely. All right, Jeff, you got some of those questions?
You know, Corbis, let me commend you. Your obvious knowledge of the subject is excellent, and your ability to describe it is wonderful. And as somebody that goes on these shows quite often too, I know how difficult it can be, and you do it very well.
Thank you.
I wanted to go back to what you guys were talking about a little bit about Faust, because Faust was describing his deal with the devil, but not necessarily like a contract where money was passed back and forth between two men. It was more about the conscious decisions that human beings make about good and evil and whether they should or shouldn't commit a crime or hurt another human being. And I think that is the type of thing which happens every day for all of us. And not to that extent, but for some. And I think to sell Faust's story short, because there's no such thing as a deal with the devil, that wasn't what he was trying to describe in his book.
I agree. I'm just going in depth on Paradise Lost and the story of Faust and everything in my book, because I'm trying to show a parallel of how the projected mental aspects of the devil evolved,
right,
where he became more human and more us, as opposed to being an almost alien creature, you know, void of any humanity. But I agree with what you're saying there. I think that my favorite movie almost is Al Pacino in The Devil's Advocate, and I think that is one of the finest modern-day depictions of that interpretation, where you supposedly crave power, wealth, and even deeper than that, I think the subtleness of both stories is humanity wanting to prove something about itself or seek something deeper of their fullest potential. You know, with Faust, I believe he was, you know, selling himself because he wanted knowledge. He wanted to experience and enjoy everything, and, you know, then his life was going to be over. But he felt it was worth the risk to fully appreciate and understand life itself. And I think that the lawyer character in the other movie, he was trying to live to his own personal fullest potential. And then, of course, Hollywood had to give the whole spooky devil Christian, you know, slant at the very end. But prior to that, I think it was fabulous. So I think that's very much on the money.
I agree with you. Now, does Satanism have a reward and a punishment like Satanism would have as far as like heaven and hell?
We do. It's called cause and effect. It's called responsibility, consequences for our actions. It's in the everyday real world. Whatever you choose to do, it will come back to you. You know, you can only get away with certain misdeeds for so long, and then you get a bad reputation. Therefore, being a cheat will only get you so far, and then later you can never recover from the bad things that you yourself have chosen to do to yourself. So I kind of prescribe to Satanism as being immediate justification or reward. Because if you work hard and you acquire the things you want, you have a better life. I'm not saying all of us can become Gene Simmons, Donald Trump sort of stature, but, you know, those individuals did become who they are because of their own free will. And I think that people that sit in federal penitentiaries versus Gene Simmons, you know, those are the hell versus heaven here on earth that Satanism is talking about versus the intangible metaphorical heaven and hell that Christianity prescribes to. I kind of feel a little sad for some Christians who say, you're going to go to hell because of what awful things you've done, or they feel that they will because they did something bad. That's not fixing the problem that has caused those bad feelings. That's just putting a Band-Aid on it, saying that it'll go away and fix itself in the hereafter. Why not fix the problem here and now?
Interesting response. I tend to be, I guess I'm one of the few left that believe without religion, for the past 1,000 years. I don't know if our civilization would have survived any more world wars or any more nuclear, those type of things. And I think that punishment and that reward is something that many human beings need to live a good life. Have you ever read the book Heart of Darkness, Joseph Conrad's masterpiece that they turned into the movie Apocalypse Now?
Right. I did for college literature.
Okay, way back. It's like a Bible to me. I love to read it once in a while. But it discusses what happens to man when you take him away from the pressures of religion, so to speak, and civilization, and put him into the jungle and allow him to go back to where he wants to be.
And I don't know about that. I would challenge it by saying that Satanists don't have that same... do this, don't do that, as far as what the higher power says you should. But we have common, which is where ethics and morality truly come from, is cause and effect. If you do heinous things, it's going to come back on you.
How does it come back on you?
There's consequences for your actions. If you're constantly a thief or terrible to people, saying the Ebenezer Scrooge to, Enron, those things do come back to bite you. It's not about religion, it's about consequences.
Well, does Satanism believe in, like, our civilization and the rule of law?
We believe in the rule of law. We believe in justice. There's an amazing amount of people in law enforcement that are Satanists or atheists. A great number of people in the military, such as myself a long time ago, are Satanists, and at least in their mentality, because it's very much a practical, realistic, real world, you do this, this happens, because it's for the betterment of everyone that you follow the rules of common courtesy, because doing good for other people just makes sense to us, because you're going to get it back. It's not about because the invisible man in the sky says so. It's because if you're nice to me, I'm going to be nice back. That's usually a human reaction.
I agree with what you just said. I wasn't trying to be antagonistic. I'm trying to ask some
probing
questions
right.
That do for our listeners' effect. But let me skip over to the paranormal now. I'm fascinated with the paranormal. I know Jeffrey is too. That's maybe his favorite. And what do you believe, and what does Satanism believe about this thing that 60 to 100 million people in America believe in, about spirits and life after death and seeing quote-unquote ghosts? What do you believe about that?
Well, first I'll tell you what the official Church of Satan stance is. Pretty much we don't believe in an afterlife. When you die, that's pretty much it. Therefore, there are no ghosts per se. But I will be quick to also say that Satanists and myself in general are very interested in the macabre and the occult and spooky things. We are basically the Addams Family sort of thing.
Okay.
We enjoy the dark trappings, of course, because look at the motif that we employ in our rituals and our appearance, when we're not just in the solid black suits. We like all of these things because they tap into the dark archetype and the shadow psychology of human beings. And as far as residual energy of those who have departed, we see that in a scientific standpoint, that until we're proven wrong, we believe that they are simply the aftermath, the ripple effect of the energy that exists within all people. We have a nervous system. We have energy in the body. So hauntings come from two different things. The residual energy was left over somewhere, because you can't totally, obliterate anything. Einstein proved that.
Exactly.
So, the Satanists are realistic and practical, scientific-minded people. So we kind of prescribe to Einstein's theory there. energy and matter cannot be destroyed. So when the body and the, you know, what other people call the soul dissipates, then it has to be somewhere. So, you know, we're kind of open-minded when it comes to where did the energy go. As far as the person, we think they're dead. As far as the sounds that you hear and, you know, the apparitions and things like that, I would also turn to science for that one, too. It's just we haven't fully understood or explored it deep enough to understand what it is we're seeing. I remember years ago when Jack Palance was still alive. He was doing a guest voiceover on the television for Ripley's Believe It or Not. And there was a story about an old western town where people would go into this old inn. I believe it, there was a bar or something, and you could hear the clinking of pool cues when, I don't even know if there was a pool table still in the room or not. And scientists came in and they discovered that there was lead paint so thick in the walls that it actually emitted the sounds from over 100 years ago. And if the atmospheric conditions and weather and everything was just right, it would almost play it back, but it was distorted. So, you know, I would kind of say, well, maybe there's some reality there. So maybe it is multiple types of energy. Maybe it is the leftover of some type, but I don't believe it's sentient.
You know, I think that's an excellent way to put it. That's my feeling as well. I don't know if I believe in ghosts and spirits, but as you said, there is no extinguishing of energy once it's here on our planet, and there is an energy in our bodies and in our souls, and it has to have gone somewhere, or it has to be remaining somewhere when we die. And I don't think we as civilization or science have answered that question yet. And I think when we do answer it, many of the questions about the paranormal will be answered.
I agree. I don't think there's too many even Satanists who will go out there and say, it's all full of crap, therefore, you know, I'm not interested in it at all. We're saying we're skeptical objectionist, but we're still fascinated by it. We still want the same answers that everybody else does.
One more question for you. I get asked to discuss the subject of evil quite often at the conferences I go to, and I found that despite it being a word that all of us are aware of and use quite often and think we know what it means, There are very few good explanations what exactly evil is. Do Satanists have an idea about evil?
In the simplest way of expressing it, Magus Anton LaVey once said, good is what you like, evil is what you don't. It was a very open-minded, practical response in, you know, basically looking at everybody in church and other highbrow, holier-than-thou, you know, actions. They would condemn certain people during the, you know, Dark Ages, and, you know, Galileo and people like that were almost put to death because they said things that were heretical. But at the same time, they were very wise people ahead of their time. So, and now, whether the world is not flat, would have put someone to death in the past, which one's evil? So it's all, to some degree, I won't say it 100%, to some degree, it's a matter of perspective of whose ethics is, you know, being used at the particular moment. But I think there's some universal taboos and crimes that we all would agree on, no matter what walk of life we come from. Child molestation and, you know, cannibalism and things like that. Those are truly heinous and evil, but those aren't edicts from a so-called devil. Those are what man chooses to do to man.
So, you know, as I agree with you, one man's morality is another man's evil, and it basically is determined by what side of the globe you're on quite often or what religion you believe in.
Exactly.
All right, Jeffrey, it's up to you now.
All righty. So one question that I was thinking about is, what is the difference between a Luciferian and a Satanist?
I don't want to anger the Luciferians because some of them really like my work, but I will have to say, as a Satanist and a media agent for them, that there's a huge difference. We both usually believe in the same sins and laws and everything else that Danton LaVey came up with, because you'll see the sigil of Baphomet and the laws and everything written on both websites. But Luciferians truly believe that the devil does exist, that it's not just an archetype, that it is their male deity, just like in paganism where you have the god and the goddess. They use, you know, the devil as the male aspect, and as female aspect they use Lilith or something like that, the Christian consort of the devil that a lot of people don't know came from the Jewish Talmud. But they pretty much follow most of the same things, but they'll actually do the rituals not as an emotional decompression, but as believing purely that they're communicating with the lower forces, so to speak. That's, in a nutshell, the best way I can describe it, although there's probably a lot more wider disparaging differences than that.
Gotcha. I'm just curious. I don't know much about Luciferians at all, but I was just curious.
A lot of the different branches of it aren't even, you know, Satanism that's twisted. It's it comes more from the Carthers back in the Knights Templar period of the Crusades, where there was a group similar to the Templars that basically said they twisted everything around in Christianity, saying, well, God is evil because he condemned his son and mankind to war, and, you know, the devil is the fallen one, and he wanted to speak up and stand up for mankind because he said, you know, we don't have to do this, we don't have to do that. He was our Prometheus. If we're familiar with the legend of Prometheus the Titan, who brought fire to man, you know, they kind of flip things on end. So, you know, I talk about that in I, Lucifer, too, because it's an aspect of Satanism.
Yeah, Prometheus is, you know, it's kind of like the coyote story, supposedly the true story of coyote fire to man. And of course you have the Prometheus movie that I want to see eventually at some point. That just came out by Ridley Scott, which I believe is more of a history of mankind and alien origins and our creators and things like that. Which
is good, yeah. I won't spoil it for you, but it was awesome.
Yeah, I want to see that for sure, definitely. So what, did you see it recently?
Yes, I just went out to watch it the other night, actually.
Nice. Yeah, I've been reading about it. I'll see it soon at some point, or acquire it somehow.
I will say, for fans of Ridley Scott's Aliens and Blade Runners, you'll both be impressed with the fact that they answered a ton of questions but opened up just as many more new ones. So I'm pretty sure there's a sequel to this.
Cool. Yeah, Ridley Scott, definitely. That's good that he tackled that subject. He's supposed to be doing a Moses movie, which you probably wouldn't like.
Actually, I do find myself enjoying a lot of it. I mean, it's like I said earlier, I'll go see Percy and the Lightning Thief just like I would Passion of the Christ and things like that, because I'm open-minded and I want to see and feel and experience what other cultures, you know, believe in, because I'm not going to be a closed-minded individual that says, I hate everything that isn't what I am. That's the opposite as it is.
So, where does, you've read a book about different subcultures, or the vampire subculture, or it was one of
yes.
your first books. What was that called
right.
again? I had it somewhere. What was the title of that?
That is Embracing the Darkness, Understanding Dark Subcultures, and I also wrote The Lure of the Vampire, Our Sexual Attraction to the Undead, and both of those books have a section on the vampire subculture.
Cool. Yeah, we have, not this weekend, but next weekend, Father Sebastian's coming on about vampire men.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right, Father Sebastian and I are old acquaintances.
Cool. Yeah, he'll be on, I think, what day is that? Let me look. The 23rd, yeah, because next week is the UFO dude and Tony Toppin as co-host, and then the 23rd is Father Sebastian, and Jeff will be back for that one. So, looking
okay.
forward to that. Yeah, I talked to Father Sebastian. He definitely, still on a ball in France with all these gothic vampire chicks. It can't get any better than that, I would think.
Oh, yeah. he started out in New Orleans taking over the Anne Rice Ball and turned it into the Vampire Masquerade Ball in New Orleans, and now it's in Paris, and he wants to do another one, I believe, in Italy. I can't remember where all else, but he's really going places with it.
Nice. So as far as the vampire subculture, what is your view on that as far as the vampire in general? We all know what the folklore vampire is and the Hollywood vampire, but what about people that say they're vampires? What do you think they really are? I mean, what is it? Is it more of an energy transference, or do you think it's, what's your take on that exactly?
I do know quite a few people, like Father Sebastian Jay and, you know, others in the community, for a very long time, are very good friends of mine, most of them. And for the most part, it is an energy deficiency that they believe that they are engaging in a method to replenish their depleted reserves. That just regular food and rest and things like that are not sufficient enough, and that they require the emotional, you know, skin-to-skin bonding, some of them prescribe to blood ritual or, you know, sharing in a sane, safe, and consensual manner. They get each other tested, and they use lancets or, you know, something small to prick each other's skin, and they feel that the energy transference is through blood itself, similar to the Christian idea of the life is in the blood, which has been used in, you know, movies and, you know, vampire folklore forever as the basis for that. But I wouldn't say that it's 100% just because of the archetype of the vampire. I think it also comes from pranic and chi and energy meridians of the Hindus and, you know, other religions that are from far corners of the world also believe in the same thing. They just don't adopt a particular folklore icon to go along with it.
For some reason, since I've been in high school, I've been called a vampire, and I didn't really, you know, say, oh, I'm a vampire, but for some reason, kids call me that, you know.
Yeah.
I've been called a devil worshiper and a Satanist before when I'm really, you know, not, I've been interested in it, but I wouldn't, I'm not, I've read about it, but I, for some reason, those type, you know, labels have attracted since, like, I'm 37 now, definitely since, like, junior high. I think a lot of it's just a pale, is it kind of catches it, that automatically is a, you know, if you're pale, you can forget about it.
Yeah, I remember cashing my check one night late at Walmart. I went up to the service desk, and I was in my all-black suit, and, you know, shirt and tie was even black, and wearing a nice long overcoat, and I had just started growing out my goatee, and back then my hair was still really long, and there was two ginormous human beings in front of me wearing Nike and Adidas type clothing and, you know, the stereotypical, you know, ghetto, you know, rapper jewelry. And one of them hit me and the other one nudged the other and he says, look, vampire in Brooklyn right behind you, he's going to jump up and bite your neck. And another one said, don't talk to him, he's going to jump us. And, you know, these huge individuals were more scared of me when, you know, I'm standing there weighing, you know, 130 pounds. And, you know, I thought that was hilarious that they were calling me the scary vampire when, you know, one of them easily could have, you know, caused me bodily harm had I not been armed at the time. So it was just incredibly funny how people's perceptions just went based off of appearance. And, you know, I almost wanted them to say something to me directly, some analogy that, well, just because you look like gangbangers or, you know, drug-dealing rap stars or whatever doesn't mean you are. You're probably wonderful human beings that have great jobs, and, you know, you just choose to look that way because it's comfortable for you. Same here.
Yeah, I, in high school, I used to get a lot of bullying, and then I'd come home, my dad would beat me up for being, you know, losing fights and stuff, and then eventually I got sick, and at about 17 I went through testicular cancer, and I went through chemo. I've been healed over 15 years, but when I came back from that, I was very pale, and bald, and just I wore black. I like sunk into this wearing black thing, and I think part of me did it just because I'd been through that, you know, the tragedy of that and faced death on a level. And
congratulations, you
also
won.
Also, I did it. To cause fear, it protected me on some level, because after that, no one asked me ever again. I went back to high school, I was wearing a trench coat and pale, and of course, I got called vampire and devil worshiper, but it scared people away. They, you know, they wouldn't think about coming near me. And of course, I just went to, you know, beat cancer, so that was like added a whole other dimension of tough and, you know, spirituality to my life on some level. And definitely, you know, before then, I used to attract crazy bullies, like, you know, for no reason. Like, I remember some kid that used to eat ants and moths and, like, glue. I would try to beat me up all the time. But, like, after I came back from that, you know, wearing black, it, people just leave you the hell alone. It was great.
Right. I so totally understand. I'm what you would call an elder goth myself. I mean, I started out in the antiquity white lace shirts, and I still have one, and, you know, things like that. But I've kind of evolved it into the Addams Family modern sort of look. But it was still black. It's just more professional clothing. But, you know, it does act as a barrier, just like, you know, using the word Satan or saying you're goth or something like that. It does keep people at bay who you would normally not want to rub elbows with on a daily basis anyway. It's kind of a buffer, you against the world sort of thing, so I totally understand that.
Yeah, it puts up a defense. It's like a defense mechanism. It's like a shield on some level. Now I'm in Florida, and it's like I have some black, but it's like you have to be careful in Florida. You go outside there, in fact, you'll die just from the heat.
Right.
So what is your perspective on all the current, you know, or the satanic perspective on, as far as, like, recently, you know, in the past 2 weeks, we talked about this on the last show, the zombie cannibal situation. Over the past 2 weeks, there's just been like a mass amount of insane just acts taking place of, you know, cannibalism. I think I've read like over 10 cases. I looked for them all in Huffington Post and made this special zombie edition, Follow Your Weird News, on my website at Church of Mavis Radio. And it was just non-stop. Stories were crazy. And people are like, yeah, I know the media is dredging it up, you know, the fear for some reason. But people are like, oh, it's just the media overheightening. I'm like, yeah, on some level. But if you actually look at all the stories that have happened, it's just bizarre. There's at least 7 to 8 weird-ass stories that have taken place over the last 2 weeks. So I guess, what is your personal perspective on that, as far as, you know, so much weird shit happening at one time on a cannibalism type level?
Well, I do think it's sort of a cause and effect. It's separate yet connected to the media. I think that because a few cases happened, other crazy people might be spurned on to act sooner in similar behavior that they eventually would have done regardless, because it triggers their crazy, really. So I think it's a cause and effect, but at the same time, those people are clearly out of their minds and would be doing these sort of things anyway. I think humanity as a whole needs a wake-up call on being more prepared to deal with natural disasters or man-made or just assaults from their fellow man and not be caught off guard. Schiffer Publishing actually approached me and said they wanted to take a project that I was going to put out myself called Zombie Nation. I'm researching those very cases right now for a chapter in the book, talking about, you know, cannibalism, you know, in the modern day, heightened with drugs. May not exactly be the Hollywood fictional zombie, but it's very much the original zombie from the voodoo culture where it's actual human beings that were put into drug-like trance. If you're familiar with Wade Davis's book, The Serpent and the Rainbow, that was a doctor who went down in the 60s and 70s and actually researched voodoo and zombies, and he felt that it was a derivative of some drugs that were given to the people so that they could be mindless, obedient slaves to mine, you know, the fields and be subservient. And what we have today in the so-called bath salts, which is actually a chemical street drug, it's not real bath salts, it's not a counter Epsom salts, it's more like an LSD type of drug, that people are so jacked up on that and other things that if they're already inclined to be mentally unstable and violent, that's a horrible combination. I mean, where a police officer restrained with his weapon discharges an entire clip before someone goes down, what does the common person who doesn't have a firearm, who doesn't practice even if they do possess one, stand a chance against crazy people like that? So I am, afraid, but as a practical, gun-carrying individual, I'm licensed to carry in 28 states, so, I'm not as concerned about it as some people might be, but it's definitely something everybody should be made aware of. I do tend to think that perhaps it's coming out more and more now because there is more attention on zombies because of things like The Walking Dead is so popular. I mean, a couple years ago, we had huge amounts of attention on, oh, teenagers attacked a homeless man and drank his blood, therefore we have a slew of Murray Povich and Dr. Phil type shows of, oh, my teenager's a vampire sort of thing, and it got hyped up because True Blood and Twilight were the big craze all over, and now we have zombies. So I think it's a little bit of both.
Yeah, it's kind of like the energy from it. These entertainment shows are, whatever leaks out into the consciousness of people, and I guess the weak fall prey to it or something, or, with the drugs or whatever. I have a history of drug use. I've been clean off hard drugs for God over 16 years, and the only drugs I would do now if I could find them were, like, weed and, like, Xanax or something. And I don't even do that now just because I'm in a town where they treat it like it's cocaine or something. If they find it on you, or weed especially, I think where I'm at in Florida, they still think weed's like cocaine or something. But but as far as the drug thing, I mean, as experimenting with drugs after my dad died on many levels, I've never wanted to eat anyone. So I think it's just a mix of ignorance and weak-minded people, and I just can't imagine, most people do drugs to, get rid of stress and, to have pleasure on some level, not to, suddenly want to eat someone. I could see someone, I'm going to get ass off tonight so I can go out and eat someone.
Right. I mean, one person was high on multiple drugs and intoxicated and had a history of mental conditions. That's what's scary to me, is you get all of those different aspects together in multiple human beings, and of course it looks like a zombie epidemic because they're out of control, they don't feel pain, and you shoot them and they don't go down right away. What is the public that's inundated by The Walking Dead TV show and other movies like Resident Evil forever going to think? Of course the media is going to latch onto that and make a huge story of it because it is something that people need to wake up to.
And the other creepy thing about it so much is how much it's ingrained in everyone's conversations. Like, my brother works at Lowe's, they're talking about it, and it's in this small country town. Like, this morning I watched Bill Maher, he's talking about it, and they had a discussion panel on it from, it's everywhere. That's the creepy part about it. It's, it affected so many people.
So something else will come up later when something else is popular and people latch onto it too. I'm not trying to dismiss any of these cases or make light of them at all. Quite the opposite. But I think that it is cyclical, and that you're going to get something else that will take its place in a few years.
Yeah. I don't know. Aliens taking our souls next.
Yeah, I mean,
this sort of thing has been around since the Lycanthropy Reader was written years ago, talking about werewolves from the Middle Ages, where people had a mental condition where they were attacking and cannibalizing people, and they called it, you know, lycanthropy back then. Now we're calling it zombies. So, you know, this is nothing new at all.
So let's switch back to the Satanism subject. There's so much, you know, people think of Satanism, they automatically go into, like, you know, sacrifices and, you know, dark set, you know, cults summoning forth the end of the world. And, you know, as far as a Satanist view of Earth, I mean, is there... There's no type end time scenario, of course, I don't think, but what is their view, like, the times we're in right now? Is there, you know, as far as, I'm trying to word it, my brain's all slow tonight, but as far as the Satanist's view of, you know, the times we're living in now, what is their perspective on that? Or what, as a group of Satanists, is there something they aspire to on the earth? Do they want to, you know, how do they want the future to, you know, be, so to speak?
Well, that's a multi-layered question. As far as the way times are right now, they're truly, other than technology, no different than they always have been. We've always had moments of great crisis, from World War II and the Great Depression and things. Of course, it's worse now because there's more people. There's worse economy and, you know, things like that, because we have worse people in charge making decisions who didn't learn from mistakes of the past. As Satanism wants for itself, we want everything that we possibly can acquire, because, like I started to say earlier before we had technical difficulties, we are elite Epicureans, and what that means is we want the finer things in the world. We want to make ourselves the ultimate best person that we can be and enjoy, you know, as luxurious as we can aspire to live without being stupid about it. I mean, don't go beyond your means if you can't afford it, because that's stupidity. But as a group overall, we pretty much kind of look at the world and everything going on in it and what direction it's going in, that things like this are kind of important, because even though it makes it rough on everyone, we do prescribe to social Darwinism, where the weak will be weeded out and the strong will survive, and the ones that survive will make things better for themselves, their families, and their communities, because they did make it through.
Yeah. So, Jeff, you got any other questions or anything you'd like to add? We're getting down to about the last 17 minutes or so.
Well, we're getting into some pretty heady stuff now about social Darwinism and the entitlements of our country and the way we help people that are poor back into, you know, the good things that I think we're lacking now because of the death of religion. And I don't want to, you know, upset the show at the end, getting into the politics like that, and whether we're Republicans or Democrats, but there are times here upon us and coming that I believe that we all need to step forward and help the poor and the ones that aren't able to fend for themselves, and that's just something that I don't agree with.
It definitely feels like our country right now and the world in general is on the verge of a giant shit storm of just freaking, I hate the word apocalypse because it seems religious, but it just seems like it's on the edge of oblivion right now. And it feels hopeless as far as politically and government and stuff like that. It just seems freaking hopeless, honestly. That's how I feel when it comes to politics right now, or any of those goofballs helping us do anything. But
they're only out for themselves, and the sooner we all realize it, the better off we'll be.
Yeah, it's definitely just horrible. The dollar just got knocked out of the number one place in the reserve, and I think the euro or something there. I don't remember which ones, but the dollar's not number one anymore on the reserve, and that, you know, it's just bad.
It's bad for us, but good for other people, I suppose. It's semantics and whose side is on the winning end. I mean, if you're, say, the holder of the euro dollar versus the American, then your country is doing great and everybody else is bad. You can profit off of them because they're needing the help, and you loan them money and they pay you back with interest. That's capitalism. I'm not saying that it's good that we have economic crises, but I think it makes the strong and smart people plan and prepare so that they can survive and come out ahead. I don't want to go on a tangent either about politics or religion per se, but this is all about responsibility to the responsible. So if we're smart human beings, we will use our resources and our hard work to put back some dollars, put back, you know, anything extra that we can. And, you know, it's kind of like I like to tell people, it's like Y2K. It didn't really happen, but for those of us that prepared for it regardless, we had an abundance of things when we hit on personal hard times right afterward, because I lost my job and couldn't find work for 6 months, and yet all the food and everything else and car, you know, repair supplies that I purchased for the so-called inevitable really came in handy. And I think people that do that sort of planning and preparation on a constant basis when things get really hard on them, they can just sit back and go, okay, it's hard, but I'm going to get through it. And I think if we all teach each other how to sustain ourselves and help each other through the rough times, I think we're going to make it through.
Hopefully. So I wanted to get into the Holmes thing a little bit. Jeff's forte, H.H. Holmes. Any questions that revolve around that, Jeff, that you had? For him, because he said that Corvus had said that he agreed about the Jack the Ripper Holmes situation. You're familiar with Holmes, right? Corvus, that's Jeff's book, and he's related to the madman.
Unfortunately, I've never read your work. I would definitely love to, because I certainly agree with your theory on the Jack the Ripper thing, because it happened around the same time period. They were both medically inclined people. And there's just way too many similarities from the documentary that I watched recently about it. And I think we all have a fascination at some level with people that do this sort of thing. I mean, we like to hide under the covers or under the bed away from the boogeyman, but we can't escape it, so we'll peek out and try to understand it.
Well, I'm glad you agree, and it's starting to, when I first came out with the theory that I thought that my great-great-grandfather was Jack the Ripper, which, when you think of it, is a strange subject to make. I mean, a strange sentence to state on the air. I was beaten down loudly for it, and now, recently, like your opinion agreeing, and the last show I was on, we had a forensic expert come on and say that he had thought that that same theory. He had the theory 4 or 5 years before I wrote the book. So it's fascinating to contemplate. And now I have a Hollywood entity that's interested in putting a miniseries together of the actual trial of H.H. Holmes as Jack the Ripper, with reenactments of each killing in between. So with the judge and a jury and real lawyers. So it's we're getting very close to fruition, and maybe we won't be able to absolutely prove that he was Jack the Ripper, but maybe we'll get to beyond a reasonable doubt, which is the standard that we have of the system, and maybe we can put this mystery to bed. Although we're going to face a struggle, because most people don't realize that Jack the Ripper is $1 billion industry a year. In London, in the literary world, and in the cinema world. So it's there's a lot of people that don't want the mystery solved, and certainly not by having it be proven to be a doctor from Chicago.
Right. I'm fascinated by serial killers and, you know, mass murders and things like that. I mean, it's the dark side of psychology, and, you know, we can't hide from it. We might as well face it. I am curious, as a criminal justice bachelor major myself right now, I do understand due process and, you know, how crime and research and court trials and such work. It helps me as a writer in investigation and research, but coming from the other side of the coin, I've also been a radio host for a year or two myself on Embrace the Dark Radio on Para-X and some other stations. What would you say to the point that popped into my head while you were talking, that maybe people don't want their myths shattered with reality? Because we love the Jack the Ripper story because it's never been solved. If you come forward and explain it all away, you're taking away Santa Claus.
You know, Corvus, you're correct. And it's like this last year, I'm sure you've seen the advertisement for the last author that came out with a theory about who the Ripper was. He said it was a woman, which, if you know anything about the Ripper story in Victorian London, how difficult that concept would have been in reality. Plus, but most people don't understand it, was there were four or five eyewitnesses to the Ripper killings, which the London police and Scotland Yard actually had turned into forensic drawings in 1995. I've got some copies of them, but it certainly wasn't a woman. It certainly wasn't a woman, but here we have a book by a famous author being run out by a huge publishing outfit, trying to sell a million copies to foolish readers that want their legend upheld and their mystery continued, like you say.
Right. You and I definitely need to talk some more in the near future, because there's a side project I'd like to put out and maybe work with you on something along these lines. So it's definitely a course of study that I like.
I'd like to do that. I tell you what, just Google bloodstains, one word, and our webpage comes up at the top, and we can get together.
Okay, sounds great. Thank you.
Yeah, he's on my friends list too. Both of you guys are, so y'all can just Facebook too.
Oh, good.
Well, we're getting down to the last few minutes. Let's, what are your links, Corvus, and I'd like for you to tell us about your next book coming out a bit, and then we'll depart.
Okay. I have my very next book that's coming out is this November by Schiffer Publishing, called Haunted Asylums. It's an amazing color photograph book on 50 or more different sanitariums that were closed, mostly here in the U.S., but some abroad, that have a history reputation that were allegedly haunted. And just the skeptic in me was by the photos and the stories of the reality of what happened, let alone the people that enjoy the ghost hunting aspect will equally love it as well. It's actually up on schifferbooks.com. I believe that's the URL. It kind of escapes me. It's rather late. But that's under my real name, E.R. Bernor, and if you look in the bio on the Schiffer page, it also says, also known as Corvus Nocturnum. They did that because they wanted to appeal to the wider audience of people that might shy away from the pen name that I chose years ago, so I'm kind of experimenting with using both together. But it's just an incredible work. It was a lot of fun to put together. It certainly opened my eyes up on the barbaric treatment that we supposedly did to help people, but we actually made the problem far worse. So that comes out in November, and I've got multiple projects of my own through darkmoonpress.com coming out, both books that I'm publishing of other people's as well as my own. There's Goth Girls, Vampire Vixens, and Satan Sirens coming out. It's a photo book for a little bit more mature, but not X-rated by any means, of beautiful gothic women and hiding them. Yeah. that's coming out fairly soon, in a couple months. I actually am trying to... Well, everybody likes the hot goth girl, so, you know, we're really putting it out there with Vampire Wear Clothing and some other people. I'm trying to get the author of Dissecting Marilyn Manson to write the introduction for me, Reverend Gavin Badley. So we'll see if that comes about, too.
Nice. Yeah, I'll have to contact you and see if I can hook up with a copy of In Exchange, do something on Examiner for it. That would be cool. My Examiner is doing That's very funny. Nice. That's something
I'll get a copy ahead. Out to you for sure. Yeah, if people want to meet me and get a copy signed, I will be at Scarefest in Kentucky in Lexington at the end of September.
Cool. Well, yeah, and I'll do something nice on Examiner for it when I get it, for sure. And that's one thing to mention. This week, I've had, lately on my Examiner, I've just had the most blessed luck with interviews and them getting reposted. I've been reposted on Coast to Coast, which is just beautiful. I got reposted, I did a Nick Redfern, Pyramids in the Pentagon, his new book, got reposted on Nick's blog. I did an interview with David Polides about Bigfoot, and he came out with the controversial statement that a lot of DNA tests that have come out have tested human for Bigfoot, meaning Bigfoot's more human than ape. That caused a shot form in the Squatch community. That got reposted by Nickel. On Crypto Mundo, Lauren Coleman's site. So, it was excellent. And if anybody wants to look at those articles, make sure you go to, you can either see them on my Facebook page at Reverend Critchett or go to the Church of Mabus radio show group on Facebook and you can find them in there. But I've been having just some great luck with my Examiner lately, finally.
Well, that's great. I know Coast to Coast is a very big deal. A couple of my friends are on there often, and I was contacted by them once to do Allure the Vampire, but timing didn't quite work out. So if you ever get any reviews of my work on there, I'd certainly be delighted to hear about it.
Cool. Yeah, I'll get in touch with you. Well, we're getting down to the last minute here, so... Next Saturday will be Jim Maroney and Britain's Madman, Mad Hatter, Tony Topping. And then the next week after that is Jeff Mudgett again with Father Sebastian on his book Vampire Magic. And then the last show of this month is Tree Peaker Sasquatch book of having your own Sasquatch encounters. These guys claim they can teach you how to have your own Sasquatch encounter. So, hey, we'll see how that one goes. I laugh, but there's really, you know, there's something to the Sasquatch thing, even though I still laugh about it. But nonetheless, Corbett, it's been great. Great interview. Definitely enjoyed it. And Jeff, we'll see you with Father Sebastian, not next weekend, but the next. And check out bloodstainsthebook.com for Jeff's book about H.H. Holmes. And everybody have a good weekend, and we will catch you next trip around. Take care, everybody. Good night.